The local businesses and organizations that underwrite WORT's programming play an important part in your community radio station's financial health. When you visit WORT underwriters, please let them know that you appreciate their support of the station. For information on how to become a WORT underwriter, contact Doug Holtz at 256-2001 or check out our website at WORTFM.org.
And you're listening to WORT 89.9 FM in Madison. Stay tuned for Her Turn.
Good morning and welcome to Her Turn, a program of news and information by and about women. I'm Sandy Janigold, and today is our monthly call-in show, so we do have a guest on the line. Our guest today is Patricia Smith. She is a certified compassion fatigue specialist and founder of the Compassion Fatigue Awareness Program Project. Compassion Fatigue Awareness Project. Patricia Smith is also a journalist, author of To Weep for a Stranger, Compassion, Fatigue, and Caregiving. Her newest book is Compassion Satisfaction, 50 Steps to Healthy Caregiving. And good morning, Patricia.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us. It's a pretty dreary, rainy day here in Madison.
Oh, I hate to tell you, but it's a gorgeous morning here in California.
I knew you were going to say that, but that's good.
Yeah, but we have no water. So, you know, we're in a drought.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So one balances out the other, doesn't it?
I suppose so. Why don't we start with you kind of explaining what compassion fatigue is?
Okay. This is about caregiving, and it is compassion fatigue is basically a combination of physical, emotional, and spiritual depletion that's associated with the trauma-related work where we take care of others who are in significant pain or suffering. Dr. Charles Figley actually coined the phrase, it's been his life's work, in 1995, and I can read to you as his exact quote. Compassion fatigue is a state experienced by those helping people in distress. It is an extreme state of tension and preoccupation with the suffering of those being helped, to the degree that it can create a secondary dramatic stress for the helper.
And we are talking about, to a certain extent, people that give one-on-one care to say parents, siblings. But you're also talking very much about people that are in so-called helping professions, teachers, nurses,
yes,
social workers, people that volunteer in animal shelters, people that,
yes,
work in other caregiving professions.
Yes, chaplains. It's what I call across the curriculum. It's anyone who is in a helping position. But family caregivers definitely have a very special situation because the emotional bond is there that has probably been there for a lifetime. And it can be a very, very difficult environment to maneuver if the relationship between the person being cared for and the caregiver do not have a healthy relationship, which often.
Now, on your website, it said that compassion fatigue is not the same as caregiver burnout, although you could have them both at the same time. What exactly does that mean?
Well, a lot of people ask the difference between stress and burnout and compassion fatigue. And stress is about being anxious and overload. Everything is coming at you. It's just too much. Then you go into burnout. And burnout is you're worn out. You just have feelings of hopelessness. You just can't do anymore because it's just gone. Then you go into post-traumatic stress, which is extreme exposure to traumatic events, and that happens to you. And then you have secondary traumatic stress, which is compassion fatigue.
And how do you...
That's too much. Are you getting all the static?
Yes.
Oh, dear.
Okay. I wonder if it would be helpful if we called you back right away, or maybe it's going to go away.
What about on my cell phone? Should we try that?
Actually, you're pretty clear right now.
Okay. So stress is too much, burnout is too little, and compassion fatigue is a secondary traumatic stress. There is definitely a difference between them. The problem is oftentimes caregivers have compassion fatigue, and they're working with burnout as well.
Mm-hmm. And if you want to join our conversation, our number is 256-2001. If you just joined us, I'm talking with Patricia Smith, who is the founder of the Compassion Fatigue Awareness Project. How do you know if you're starting to suffer the symptoms of compassion fatigue?
Well, it's a very specific set of symptoms. And we have to remember, compassion fatigue is not a disease. It's a set of symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to isolate yourself all the time, if you feel like there's just too much coming at you, too many people need you all the time, emotional outbursts, and that comes from pushing feelings down, oftentimes year after year, if you've been a caregiver a majority of your life, eventually the body says, I've had enough, and you'll have emotional outbursts that you really can't control. You have a veil of sadness and apathy, persistent physical ailments that never go away. We all know someone that has the headache all the time, or the sore throat, or the backache, or the gastrointestinal problem. That's your body being under stress, saying, please stop doing this to me. It's giving you a warning that something is wrong. Substance abuse, it's a way of self-medicating, whether it's alcohol, tobacco, drugs, pornography, whatever it is that you become addicted to help you get away from those feelings. You have hypervigilance, hyperarousal. Someone drops a book and you jump 3 feet off the ground. Then when you get into recurring nightmares or flashbacks of traumatic events, that's probably when you definitely need to go to a mental health professional who can help you get through this.
One of the other things that's said on the website, I'm talking about people who are in these professions that very often suffer from compassion fatigue. It says they are people who are taught from an early age to care for the needs of others before their own needs. Authentic, ongoing self-care practices are absent from their lives. So we're talking about people that are kind of have a predisposition or something to begin with.
There are a number of causes, and probably one of the main causes is what we call other-directedness. It usually starts in childhood, and you're a family caregiver, or perhaps your family has some dysfunction, and you become the parent as a young child. So you're always looking out, you're hypervigilant for everyone else, and you always put the needs of others before your own needs, and you bring those practices and behaviors into your adult life.
And how did you get involved in this? How did you decide to start this project?
Well, it started 15 years ago. I'm not a mental health professional. If you ask me to diagnose your symptoms, I would have to tell you that I really, can't do that. What happened was that I was a single parent, and I, when my last daughter went off to college, my background is journalism. I was a correspondent for the San Jose Mercury News, and I worked in college textbook publishing to feed my kids. And when my last one went off to college, I thought, I want to do something that I want to do, that I would enjoy. I want to work with animals because I'm an animal lover, not realizing the underbelly of animal welfare work, which can be pretty devastating. So I went back and I got a training and development certification up at UC Santa Cruz, which isn't far from where I live. And I looked at that time on Craigslist, and there was Humane Society Silicon Valley, a training and development manager. So I applied, and I got the job. And 2 weeks into the job, the executive director came to me, and remember, this is in the year 2000. She was so ahead of her time. She said, I'd like you to do a shelter-wide training on compassion fatigue. And I think there were about 125 of us on staff at that time. So I didn't know what it was. I went up to my office and I Googled it, and the only thing that came up was the academic work of Dr. Charles Figley, who was then at Florida State University. So unknowingly, that this man is a world-leading traumatologist, I emailed him and told him what I needed to do and that I worked with academics and I felt that I could take his work and bring it to a place where the rest of us could understand. So long story short, I did that, and we did a self-care test that Dr. Beth Hudnall-Stam has put together. It's her life's work. And oddly enough, out of all of those people, I had the highest levels of compassion fatigue. And that started me on a journey. And I went through a year of taking time off, and I went and lived over on the coast and, you know, walked every day and tried to figure out what my part in it was, what I did, how to heal. And after a year of that, I was back to good health, and I was talking to my son, who's a marine biologist, and I said, I think I have something to share with others. This is fascinating work, and et cetera, et cetera. So he said, why don't you set up a website, and we'll see what happens. And he said, what would you call it? And I said, I'd call it the Compassion Fatigue Awareness Project, because I believe that once you have an awareness of this, you basically can't go back. And it has been quite a ride for the last 15 years.
And you are a certified compassion fatigue specialist. How do you get certified
yes.
in that?
Well, at the time, Dr. Eric Gentry, who was another leading and still is a leading traumatologist, was doing certification courses in New Jersey. So I went back there and took a course. And there are places that you can go, you know, to take courses and be certified to help others. Dr. Figley has the Green Cross organization, and they offer certifications. There's a number of them. If you Google compassion fatigue certification, a lot of these will come up. And I highly recommend it to anyone who, you know, would like to do this work, because you have to make sure that you're in a good place to be able to help others, mm-hmm. or you will take on all their pain and suffering and become more compassion fatigued.
Well, and also, as you talk about, this is also where elder abuse and other kinds of abuse
yes.
come in, because you start taking
you
it
exactly
out.
You're exactly right. There's anger involved, and who gets it is the poor, you know, usually helpless, either animal or person who can't do anything, and they're the ones who get the abuse, because the poor caregiver, you know, is compassion fatigued.
And if you just joined us, I'm talking with Patricia Smith, who is the founder of the Compassion Fatigue Awareness Project. Give us a call if you have any questions, you want to join our conversation, or you have some experience with this. Our number is 256-2001. And you had said in an interview, Patricia, when you were talking to somebody that worked for an animal shelter, that a lot of times working with animals is really brings on compassion fatigue in a way that perhaps it doesn't when you're working with people.
Well, I believe that's true, having worked in the animal welfare you know, environment. And it's mostly because everyone who goes into it loves animals. And then it doesn't take long before you see the abuse and the hoarding and the disrespect for animals that society has. And it never stops. It just goes on and on and on, and you keep working harder and harder, and it never gets any better. And you have to deal with a public that is, you know, somewhat ignorant of the ways of animals, and then, of course, you have the animals themselves. You know, they can't speak for themselves, so you're their voice, and you're taking on that, you know, part two. And then oftentimes, you know, perfectly wonderful animals have to be euthanized for lack of space or because they start acting out. And so the whole situation is really, really sad. You know, there are the good things, of course, when you adopt an animal or, you know, something like that. But for the most part, it's a very difficult environment to work in every single day because it never gets better.
Mm-hmm. I actually volunteered at a shelter a long time ago and found that I had to sort of put a wall between myself and the animals in terms of just saying I'm doing for them what I can do today, and that's all I can do.
Oh, that's extremely healthy. I mean, that's a healthy caregiver. A healthy caregiver is someone who has very strong personal boundaries, and you're there to help, and it is really a gift that you're, you know, there at that point to help either an animal or a person. But a lot of, unfortunately, a lot of caregivers, they become, you know, so compassionate that it can hurt them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, empathy means we open our hearts to the pain and suffering of others. Compassion means that we're moved to alleviate that suffering. And what happens is if you don't alleviate it in a healthy way by just following the path with the person and not trying to make it better for them, I mean, you are in a sense, but mm-hmm. you don't have the power to run the show or to be in control. So what you want to do is you just want to be there as a helper, whether you're a professional or a family caregiver.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that you and I have in common, my paid work is for the Ronald McDonald House here in Madison.
Yes.
And
yes.
You were a program director at the Ronald McDonald House in Stanford for quite a while.
Yes.
And actually, the house was awarded in 2005 a Best Bets Award for its Healing Hearts program that you were a part
yes.
of. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, that was another exceptional, you know, learning experience to work there. The house at Stanford is number one. It's just a beautiful place. We always had 47 families there. But we did lose the little ones, you know, constantly. And there were only 8 of us on staff, and we had about 300 volunteers that helped mm-hmm. us run that whole house and all the activities. And actually, the volunteers worked, that was my job, is to work with the volunteers, and they were all wonderful. And what we would do when we would lose a little one, the staff, we had different things for the volunteers, but the staff would get together in one of the rooms, and for about a half an hour, we would talk about the child, and we wouldn't talk about the details that were terribly upsetting, that traumatized us. We would talk about, you know, what a sweet child and what a wonderful family, and remember that time, you know, she came to my door and she gave me the little stuffed ladybug, and we would reminisce and cry. And, you know, after debriefing for about a half an hour, we'd sort of look at each other and say, well, there are 47 other families out there who need us now. And it would help the pain and suffering of the loss move through us so that we could go out and continue to do the work that we did every day. And overall, we were a highly healthy group, I believe, because of the teamwork and that we were very tuned in to each other. You know, you can't help it, but you do have your favorites. You know, every once in a while, a child will come through that will capture your heart in a way that the others don't. And we would watch out for each other. And then, like I said, we had the healthy debriefings, which I think was probably the best thing we could do for each other.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've worked in nonprofits for probably almost 30 years, but I am an accountant, and so I've always been in the business end of it. So a lot of that has kept me more buffered from some of the things. And at our house, Ronald McDonald House, it seems like a lot of the kids that are getting care are usually in the hospital, or I don't see them a whole lot. So,
oh, okay.
But there certainly are some that are around. And of course, when the parents lose a child and the family loses a child, that's quite something to deal with, too.
It is. And that's what I say, you know, there's the ripple effect. Of course, you've lost a child that you're very attached to, but you become so attached to the families, particularly the mothers, who are usually the ones who end up staying at the house
mm-hmm.
With other siblings, so the father can work and continue to support the family. So it's a very intense environment, but it's also tremendously satisfying work.
Now, when you were talking about family caregiving, because obviously this is going to be my personal therapy session with you, Patricia, because
and that's just fine.
I'm also a family caregiver. One of the things that you say that I want to get into very much is what people, caregivers, need to do for themselves
yes.
to keep themselves or to get themselves out of it or hopefully to do things so that they don't get into compassion fatigue to begin with. But my parents are in their 80s. They live in Milwaukee, and I am very fortunate to have 4 other siblings that all live over there, a lot of nieces and nephews. Everybody lives in Milwaukee but me. So there's a lot of us that do that. But I got to tell you, before my parents moved into assisted living, I was getting to the point where I was starting to resent just the heck out of them. The appointments they had to go to. My stepmother broke her arm twice in 2 months and had to be in rehab. And so my dad couldn't drive. And so we're driving him back and forth, and we had to stay at the house with him. And not everybody was willing to do that. And it was terrible.
Yes.
And that's what...
You know, just an array of feelings. There's guilt. There's resentment. You love them. It's a roller coaster ride, and I hear that from so many, you know, family caregivers. And you mentioned siblings. I think one of the best things you can do is build a healthy support system. I mean, even if you have to make an Excel file about who's going when and who's doing what,
mm-hmm.
you know, if everyone can bring their own gifts to the table, it really, really helps because everyone feels like they're doing something. And a healthy support system and some form of spirituality have been found with a recent Harvard study. The best thing for resiliency for humans is some sort of spirituality. It doesn't mean an organized religion, and if it does, that's fine too. But you have to find something to fill you up because you deplete every day, and then you have to fill up every day. And this is the thing I think that most people don't understand, is the best thing you can do for yourself while going through any kind of caregiving situation is practice authentic, sustainable self-care daily. And it has to be authentic to you, something that fills you up, and it has to be sustainable to sustain you throughout the situation. And as I said, it's every day. It's deplete, fill up, deplete, fill up. And, you know, oftentimes a physician or even a psychologist will tell someone, you need 2 weeks in Hawaii or you need 2 weeks in the Caribbean. And that's great, too. But then you come right back to it.
Mm-hmm.
And before long, you're back in the trenches with it. So that's why it has to be every single day. And that's very difficult because we're other-directed and we want to take care of others first. And we have to learn to put ourselves first so we have something to give. And that's the journey. That's the healing journey, is to switch that around from becoming other-directed to self-directed. And it's difficult. I've traveled the path, and it's so difficult to change those patterns.
One of the other things you talk about is to make sure that the other relationships in your life that you're not involved in some dysfunctional relationship, and not talking about the one with the person you're giving care to,
but in
other relationships.
Well, you know, as we all know, relationships that are not healthy, that create stress and, you know, pain in our lives, it takes too much time and too much energy. And oftentimes caregivers attract what Dr. Judith Orloff calls emotional vampires. They know us. They find us. They sit next to us on a bus, and they tell us their life story. They get off the bus puffed up because they've depleted themselves, and, you know, all their pain and suffering is out there now. And we've incorporated into our pain and suffering, which is exactly what compassion fatigue is. So you have to kind of look at your relationships and maybe even take them one by one. How do you feel when you leave that person? Do you feel like you're just empty and you're, you know, exhausted? Or does that person fill you up? Do they make you laugh? Do they hug you? Do they ask how you are? You know, is it a back and forth? Is it a healthy relationship? And the others, you know, maybe put it on the back burner. And I can say honestly, I've done that in the past. It's not pleasant to do, but you absolutely have to reserve your strength to take care of whatever it is you're taking care of.
Now, mostly you're talking about caring for people no matter where it is that, for the most part, are not being abusive to you in some way. But
right.
You just be through giving care and things, you just end up with the resentment and the symptoms. What about if you're caring for somebody that is abusive? And
again, it's about personal boundaries. On my website, which is www.compassionfatigue.org, I think it's that website. I also have www.healthycaregiving.com, and there are some materials on both of the websites that caregivers can download, and one of them is the Caregiver's Bill of Rights that I put together, and it basically says, you know, you have a right to be treated with respect, and you have a right to be paid for your services if you're a paid caregiver. And, you know, someone can just go and download that and keep it close by to remind, you know, themselves that we have, you know, personal boundaries, that when someone crosses those boundaries, it's okay to say, you know, I have to leave now, I have to go, and I'll come back tomorrow. Or please don't treat me that way. It's okay to do that. And oftentimes it's very difficult, particularly in the parent-child relationship. You know, it's not easy to do. But that's part of the journey, too, is what are your personal boundaries? How much will you allow people to, you know, ask you to do things? How much will you allow them to somewhat take advantage? And I think most of us who have compassion fatigue find out that our boundaries are very wide and we have to bring them in quite a bit.
Which is
it also involves very effective communication. You know, we never lash out or blame someone or say, you always do something. We always speak from a place of I. I'm feeling like you're not respecting me right now, and I'm going to go take some time so I can, you know, build up my resources, but I'll be back tomorrow. It's okay to say that. And by doing that, you don't back someone into a corner by blaming. You always want to speak from a place of I. And that's why you have to be in touch with your feelings, which a lot of us who were young caregivers aren't in touch with our full range of human emotions because we've learned to shove them down and not deal with them because it's too difficult. And that's part of the healing process, is to experience the full range of human emotion and that it's okay. I mean, some people have told me that they're afraid to cry because they're afraid they'll never stop. And it's like, no, you will stop. You know, go ahead and let it all out.
So you've talked about...
Does that make sense for your own personal situation?
Yes.
The personal boundaries and being able to say, you know, I this is hurting me, I'm going to stop right now, but I'll be back. So you can go and gather your resources again. It's not easy to do, I know that.
I actually wrote out some rules for this person, and it's actually
good for
working
you.
Pretty
Excellent.
Good.
Excellent. Having a self-care plan is another really good thing you can do for yourself. And you have to hold yourself accountable. Make it measurable and accountable. Say you want to lose 5 pounds. I will go to the gym Monday, Wednesday, Friday for 45 minutes. And at the end of the month, you can look at your self-care plan and say, okay, well, I didn't make it on Wednesdays. Maybe Monday, Friday are the only 2 days. I mean, we have to be kind to ourselves. Self-compassion is probably the best thing we can do for ourselves as we go through this journey. And make it measurable. You know, 45 minutes. Did I stay 45 minutes? Well, no, I only stayed 30 minutes. Maybe I can do 45 minutes next week. You know, be kind to yourself. But you know, like you said, write out some things. Give them to that person that you're providing care for. And say, these are the rules for me to continue doing this. And then, of course, ask others to help. It's very hard for caregivers to ask for help. We're very much, I can do it better myself people. Because we always have.
Right. So you've given us some great ideas, especially in spiritually and emotionally. You touched a little bit on physical, but it is very important to do physical activity, I'm thinking.
Yes. There's a standards of self-care. In fact, Dr. Figley's on Green Cross, www.greencross.org. There are the standards of self-care that have been created by people who understand all of this very well. And it's all about eating well and exercising and have something that relaxes you and have what we call on-the-spot stress relievers when you're feeling like it's all coming at you too much. Nature gave us the best defense of all. And that's to breathe really, really deeply, 3 or 4 times. And it just calms us down at the time so that you don't lash out or you don't blame. And you gather your thoughts so that you can effectively communicate. So the next time you know your body tells you it's stressing up because of some caregiving situation, stop for a minute and breathe deeply 3 times. And you'll notice that you're much calmer. It calms the body down.
Well, I've really, really enjoyed talking to you, Patricia, and I thank you very much, Patricia Smith, a certified compassion fatigue specialist and the founder of the Compassion Fatigue Awareness Project, also the author of To Weep for a Stranger, Compassion Fatigue and Caregiving, and her newest book, Compassion Satisfaction, 50 Steps to Healthy Caregiving. Thank you so much for joining us, Patricia.
Thank you very much, and good luck.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And I want to let people, our listeners, know that there is a listening session on the entire Governor Walker budget, which will be tomorrow night, Monday, at 5 o'clock at Madison East High School Auditorium. State Senator John Erpenbach, Representative Chris Taylor, and other lawmakers will be there if you want to join them. And then there will be a rally this Thursday, April 2nd at 4 p.m., which is called March in Madison to hashtag SaveRUW. So if you have any other questions about those, give us a call after the show. I want to thank Samantha Burble for